And for the does my mic working? Does it work? Can you hear me back? Okay. Thank you for the invitation to come here. It's always a pleasure to be in Toronto and visit this department. I also enjoyed my day of meetings today. Very interesting schedule. Lots of exciting things done here. I suggested a couple of possible topics for this talk to Ken, and he selected graphene. And I said, "Yes, of course, yes, sir." So I'm happy to do graphene, and that's one of the things that we are working on. Graphene is a monolayer of carbon atoms. It has been isolated first in 2004, and now it's a worldwide effort. So theoretical work on graphene has preceded its discovery back in 1947. Philip Wallace has published an article on the band theory of graphite, but really in this paper he investigated a monolayer band structure of monolayer of carbon atoms. That's what we call graphene today. And Philip Wallace was born in Toronto and studied here. I think he graduated also from this university. So this is a color representation of his work on the band structure of graphene. Energy is plotted as a function of momentum, and what you see in this plot, very strongly dispersive bands, more or less like in every other solid. But there are some special features of this band structure, and there are these special points, six of them, in the band structure, and that's where the conduction band exactly touches the valence band. And here, around these special points, the dispersion energy versus momentum is linear with energy. So that's a zoomed version of what is going on around these special points. And this really defines a number of distinctive features of graphene, this dispersion. Essentially, in every other solid-state system and in any other 2D material, dispersion is usually quadratic. Energy disperses quadratically with momentum, meaning that electrons very much resemble free electrons, except for, of course, masses could be renormalized strongly in solids. Now, electrons in graphene, based on this dispersion, may be resembling closer photons, if you wish. So this linear dispersion is certainly familiar to us from photons. And all electrons in these Dirac bands, according to the discovery made by Philip Wallace, have the same velocity, just like photons have velocity of C. So this property of graphene really defines a number of its spectacular features. And the new physics of Dirac fermions residing in these linear bands has been studied quite intensively over these years and through some of the most daring experiments in all of condensed matter physics. And there are also interesting prospects for device applications, although I think realistic devices have not happened yet, hopefully sometime soon. Now, with about 42,000 publications on graphene during this 7 years and a half, it's clear that this material is keeping busy a large fraction of condensed matter community. And I think excellent help of material scientists and chemists also need to be acknowledged. I've done this literature search about a week ago, so this number is already obsolete. And that's because over these 7-8 years, on average, 2 new papers on graphene appear every day. One paper in 2 days. And that's, of course, including weekends and holidays, including Thanksgiving, south from the border. And so no matter how hard I will try to overview this field for you, this overview will be incomplete because somebody is likely to publish an article during this hour that I have. I will focus on infrared optics of graphene instead. And infrared data have allowed us to address a number of items on this new physics list. Also, infrared data may be relevant to some potential applications of graphene. Perhaps the most interesting result, in my opinion, relates to many body effects in graphene. Early evidence for this, for relevance of these effects, came from some of the conventional transmission and reflectance experiments that we've done around 2008. New insights came from imaging plasmons in graphene, which is my main topic really today. The term nanoplasmonics has an applied flavor, has a device flavor. That's why it appears on the right-hand side here. There is really a huge community trying to confine light to length scales deep in subdiffractional limit. It's really an industry, if you wish. Our take is slightly different here, and we are trying to exploit plasmons to investigate intrinsic physics of graphene, and that's what I'm going to tell you about, although there are some applied byproducts of this work as well. So this is the outline of my talk. I will start by telling you about conventional spectroscopy experiments that we have done, about features that we observe in our conductivity data that cannot be reconciled with a simple conical band structure of graphene, features that are indicative of a strong presence of interactions and many body effects in this new form of carbon. And in order to verify the role of imperfections and of other extrinsic factors, we thought it's important to perform these type of experiments, but now at the nanoscale. And that brings us to infrared nanoimaging and nanospectroscopy. As I already alluded, we tried to utilize surface plasmons to investigate graphene. You can think of a plasmon, of a surface plasmon, as of a ripple of electron density excited, triggered by light. The length scales of these plasmons are typically very small in graphene. That brings us to length scales of about 100 nanometers, maybe 50 nanometers. So anything you want to do with plasmons has to be done using subdiffractional near-field optics. And I'll tell you a little bit how this technique works. In short, we call this technique sometimes an antenna-based infrared spectroscopy. We illuminate the tip of an infrared of an AFM microscope with an infrared laser, and this allows us to launch plasmons on the surface of graphene. And through direct imaging, we see how these plasmons propagate away from the tip, how they become reflected by imperfections on the surface. In some cases, we are able to form a standing wave between the tip, between this antenna and the edge of the sample. And then we can image in real space profile of how this standing wave is decaying. And this decay rate gives us information on electronic properties of graphene layer. We call this technique plasmon interferometry. And we are very excited with the opportunities that this approach offers, and in short, this conclusion of many body effects that was inferred from some early experiments is fully consistent with our later data I guess that's expected. Otherwise, I would have chosen a different title probably for this for this talk. In the end, if time permits, I will tell you a little bit about really entirely new range of opportunities that this near-field nanoscopy, near-field nanoimaging have to offer to condensed matter physics. Okay, so this panel shows the schematics of a back-gated graphene device, graphene flake, which is a technical term for a microcrystal. Graphene flake resides on a silicon oxide wafer, and the silicon acts as a back gate. Graphene is not the only cleavable materials. There are many others, and Ken Burge here has a really very active program on trying to integrating various cleavable materials in this kind of gated structures and heterostructures even. So let's apply the gate voltage. If we apply the gate voltage, we create two accumulation layers in this device, not very different from a MOSFET structure. And this gate voltage changes quite dramatically the resistance of this device. In charge neutral graphene, in graphene where the Fermi energy is exactly at the tip of these two cones, and charge neutral graphene, the resistance is pretty high. But you can significantly reduce resistance by introducing, for example, holes in this graphene layer or electrons. And this behavior is more or less symmetric on the two sides. These are resistance even data from the Nobel Prize winning work by Novoselov and Geim. So one can understand gross features of these transport data and many other results starting from the band structure alone. And the initial impression of the community was that there was no need at all to invoke anything beyond this band structure. There was no need to invoke strong many body effects that we believe are present in graphene as well. So in my group, we started working in graphene around 2006. By then, it became possible to routinely exfoliate these microcrystals with tens of microns in size, so one can focus a beam of an infrared microscope in a sample like that. And honestly, back then, I was really driven by a technical challenge of these experiments. I didn't know if it's going to be possible to obtain quality reflectance and transmission data in infrared from a device like this. What I did know is that provided this experiment is possible, these data have a lot to tell us about physics of graphene or of any other conducting material. And the reason why for that is that for optical methods to be really very informative in condensed matter physics is that many or most interesting energy scales in solids fall somewhere in the frequency range that we can cover with infrared methods. So this is a summary of some of these energy scales. They're color-coded to represent different classes of materials that are in the vanguard of what is going on in condensed matter physics. You don't need to read them all. The point is that they all fall somewhere in the range that we can cover with infrared techniques, and graphene is among them. Wave numbers are jargon units that spectroscopists like to use. One wave number is approximately 1 Kelvin. 1,000 wave numbers is approximately 0.1 electron volt. Now, optical spectroscopy of a material is really about measuring and understanding optical constants, and the most useful for us will be the real part of the conductivity. It's both frequency and voltage dependence of this conductivity will be of significance. In the limit of zero frequency, the real part is an absorptive part. So all these different absorption channels give certain give rise to certain peaks, certain structure in this conductivity spectra that we can record. And in the limit of zero frequency, this is just the DC value. So there is always a simple connection to make to through transport measurements as well. So this this panel shows conductivity data obtained by a former graduate student in our group, Zhichang Li, who now is leading infrared program at the National High Magnetic Field Lab in Tallahassee. So these are his data. So what do we see in this spectra? First of all, what we see in this spectra is a clear threshold in the conductivity that can be shifted with gate voltage to higher energy. High is the gate voltage, further this threshold moves to near infrared and visible eventually. And then above this threshold, all these spectra merge. And they merge at one particular value, at a value given by pi e squared over 2h. And graphene aficionados will immediately recognize the universal conductivity of graphene that was predicted, in fact, long before graphene was isolated and long before these experiments have been carried out. Now, the physics of this universal conductivity is in the band structure. Graphene is a material that supports interband transitions from low field valence band to empty conduction band, supports these transitions starting from zero frequency. Probably the only material like that. And these transitions ultimately are responsible for this flat, featureless conductivity that these experiments reveal. Experiments from the Manchester group have extended these measurements into visible and near-infrared range. So this effect is really observed over a broad range of frequencies. It's sort of a curious result, but I think the most curious really part of it is that graphene is the only material that I know that has optical properties that completely independent on any material parameters. These are just frequency independent spectrum. These are all constants, and it's maybe instructive to contrast that behavior with the response of free electrons in a Drude model. That's sort of often a starting point to understand behavior of metals or conducting materials. There are at least three material-dependent parameters here. The scattering time, or scattering rate, defines the width. This is a Lorentzian centered at zero frequency, and 1 over tau would be the width of this Lorentzian, and there is also carry density and effective mass. In graphene, you don't have any of that. It's just a constant frequency-independent conductivity. So the gross features of voltage dependence are also easy to understand. Once you move Fermi energy down, you introduce a cutoff for the energy of the lowest frequency interband transition. And further you move this up or down, all transitions below this cutoff are prohibited. Because in optics, we deal only with direct transitions in momentum space, because photon momentum is essentially zero in this case. And you expect to find this strong dependence of the threshold on gate voltage. That's more or less what we observe in our data. By the way, please feel free to ask me questions anytime. I would especially enjoy questions from graduate students and postdocs.
Why does the threshold move at 1 volt per volt?
At 1 volt. So the rate at which the threshold moves is determined by the Fermi velocity of graphene, by the slope of this dispersion, and the Fermi velocity is roughly 1 × 10⁶ centimeters per second. So that just happens in this unit to move at this rate. It's sometimes useful to, by the way, when am I supposed to end? At 5 sharp. Okay, great. I know there are peculiarities with timing of colloquia in Toronto, so I just want to make sure I'm well prepared for that. So sometimes it's in optics, it is useful to look at the data from the viewpoint of sum rules. Sum rules are very basic statements that can be formulated for optical constants. These are really, sum rules rely on something as fundamental as causality and the philosophical concept, more than just physics concept. And this concept allows you to attribute the spectral weight in your data area under the conductivity curve to number of electrons divided by mass of free electrons. So just looking at this formula, you see that this area is not supposed to change at all. Okay? Yet if you look at the conductivity data, this spectral weight, this area in this shadowed region, appears to disappear. In fact, it doesn't disappear. The spectral weight is transferred to low frequencies and is recovered in the response of mobile electrons now in this Dirac bands. Okay, so this is the summary of conventional optics of graphene. Some of these data are our own data, other data from taken from other groups. So the dominant feature in mid-infrared is this threshold that moves with gate voltage. The dominant feature in far infrared at low frequencies is this Drude-like absorption due to free electrons in Dirac bands. And these features you can understand starting from this conical band structure. However, there are many other aspects of this data that cannot be reconciled with this conical band structure. And I will focus just on one. And one is this one. So if we look again at this band structure, we would expect to find no absorption whatsoever at frequencies below 2 EF. This is the lowest energy of interband transition. So absorption below 2 EF, based on this band structure, is expected to be zero. Instead, what we find in this spectra, in this region, that this absorption is as high as 30% perhaps of this universal conductivity. So we are forced to conclude that there are other processes in graphene that lift up this conductivity from zero value here to where it ends up in this spectra. So one cannot attribute this absorption to a tail of the free carrier Drude mode. Pardon my Drude feed. I had to finish that without right tools when I was doing this last moment on the plane. But that's roughly how the Drude conductivity would behaves in graphene. Graphene is a very mobile, has very mobile carriers, even modest quality of graphene. So that implies that the width of this Lorentzian peak is pretty narrow. And by the time you go to mid-infrared frequency, it basically dies off. So what could happen is that this scattering rate that defines the width of the Drude peak can become progressively broader as we move to higher and higher energy in graphene. That this process, in principle, could explain this tail in the free carrier conductivity, and this possibility of strongly frequency-dependent scattering rate is, in fact, very familiar to those who have spent time looking at dynamics of electrons in strongly correlated systems. This non-Lorentzian form of the conductivity is, in fact, one of the fingerprints of strongly interacting electrons in transition metal oxides and many other classes of materials. And the origin of this is related to electrons dragging a cloud of excitations behind them, and this flat, slowly decaying conductivity could be a fingerprint of this effect. There are other indications in these data that I'm not going to cover that all, in fact, point out to inability of simple conical band structure to explain optics results. Perhaps all these an exciting interpretation of these inconsistencies with conical electronic structure is that these experiments may be informing us of new physics that is not present in band structure alone, and new physics that requires many body effects to explain this data. But as always, there is an alternative interpretation, more prosaic interpretation, and it's quite possible that these anomalies may be extrinsic. In fact, graphene on SiO2 substrate is known to be very inhomogeneous. These are some of the early direct imaging data revealing inhomogeneities in charge neutral graphene. So we thought that before we go into some complicated interpretations of these results, we should try to exclude extrinsic factors. And in order to exclude extrinsic factors, we thought it's imperative to redo this kind of experiments, but now at the length scale that is commensurate with inhomogeneities in graphene. And this is difficult to do because the wavelength of light here in this scale is of the order, is of the size of the screen. So conventional optical methods don't really tell you much, and you have to turn to methods of near-field nanoscopy. This can be done. This can be done, and there are many ways to beat spatial limitations of diffraction using optics. The most practical implementation, we think, is this antenna-based nanoscopy. And the tip of an atomic force microscope here in this approach works as an optical antenna. So this is a zoomed version of what is going on at the apex of this tip. When you illuminate it with an infrared laser, you introduce a dipole at the apex of the tip. And when you approach your sample, where you can approach very closely, you can also collect backscattered light or front-scattered light produced by this dipole. Now, and this backscattered radiation is impacted by properties of materials that are in the proximity of this dipole. Okay? That's actually an important feature of this method. So there is no direct interaction of light with the studied material. Light interacts with this dipole, with this tip of an atomic force microscope that acts as a middleman, if you want, in this process. But backscattered radiation is impacted by the proximity of what you locate close to this dipole. And if you have two-dimensional electron gas in graphene layer, for example, you can investigate properties of this graphene layer by monitoring backscattered radiation of this tip. Now, the length scale of this technique now has nothing to do with the wavelength of light. And that's because you collect all your backscattered signal from the area under the apex of the tip. And this can be very, very sharp. And this way you can beat diffraction by 4, 5, 6 orders of magnitude, depending on the it's the spatial resolution is completely decoupled from the wavelength of the source that you use for these experiments. In my next slides, I will show you raster scanned images of graphene that will look approximately like this. These images were collected with a spatial resolution of 10-20 nanometers. Even though the wavelength of light that we used to collect these images was about 10 microns, which would be of the size of this room in this scale. Prior to working with graphene, we exploited this virtue of infrared nanoscopy to look at phase separation in various classes of materials, and we were able to do that in in vanadium dioxide, where these kind of measurements have allowed us to identify metallic droplets close to the insulated to metal transition. Now, this infrared nanoscopy is really a Janus-phased technique. And one phase of this Janus is very high spatial resolution, and that's good and that's important, but that's not all. The spatial resolution also implies access to momenta that are much greater than Q of light. And you can easily get access to Q values as high as 10 to the fifth inverse centimeters, that is of the order of the Fermi wave vector in graphene, for example, or in other materials. And generally, quite generally, a combination of this high spatial resolution and high Q values is really an uncharted territory for any material. And we are trying to take advantage of access to this entirely new parameter space that near-field nanoscopy methods offer to us. It's a little bit surprising that that not that much has been done with near-field nanoscopy, because this technique really goes back at least more than 100 years back. And some of the pioneering experiments on spectroscopy using evanescent waves that we are exploiting here in this approach are due to Drude and Nernst, and this was published in 1891. Now, the two fundamental approaches to near-field optics, this antenna-based approach that I'm telling you about today, and some other approaches based on small apertures, all these ideas have emerged from a very interesting correspondence between Irish physicist Edward Sinji and Einstein. So back in the late 20s, Sinji wrote several letters to Einstein. And in these letters, he proposed this clever way, antenna-based way, of doing infrared nanoscopy. Einstein didn't think much of the idea, but he said, well, why don't you publish it? And Sinji published it, and these are actually remarkable papers. So not only Sinji proposed two methods to perform these subdiffractional measurements, but he also, in these papers, proposed the idea of imaging by scanning, which certainly was a very new idea back then. And he also proposed that that this scanning at short length scales, at nanoscale length scales, can be accomplished with piezos. So that's precisely technology we are using today. So paper is even very well cited now, but the first citation to this work from 1928 has happened 60 years after the publication. So I couldn't show you the photograph of Sinji, Edward Sinji, but I can show you a photograph of John Sinji, who, as some of you may know, was on the faculty here at the University of Toronto for 13 years. And his connection to graphene is that he served as a thesis advisor for Philip Wallace. So there is quite a bit of history here, perhaps special for this department. So in the rest of the talk, I will show you Dirac plasmons predicted by Wallace using the technique that Edward Sinji has conceptualized. So we investigated monolayer graphene residing on SiO2 substrate. Graphene extends up to the blue dashed line in these images. And we know that from topography. AFM technique, of course, is powerful to register topography of your samples. And from this, from this image, we immediately see that graphene enhances the signal compared to SiO2 by approximately factor of 3. What I'm plotting here in this false color scale is the amplitude of backscattered signal. This enhancement is not uniform. This enhancement actually is strongest close to the sample edge, but this enhancement is also quite strong in the interior of the sample close to defects. Okay? As a side remark, I should mention that the sensitivity of this probe is really quite remarkable, and some of the weaker signals still resolvable originates from a fraction of electron in a pixel. This is another image that I think shows this oscillatory pattern of the signal quite clearly. Here we have a triangular sample. Again, we know that from topography, and this signal oscillates as we move away from the edge of the sample into interior of the sample. So this is how this slide gives you some idea of how this experiment is done. Since 2006, when we started doing this technique, we've built four of these nanoscopes. The first we built on very tiny budget through parts that we bought on eBay. This is a slightly more expensive version of this apparatus. Here the AFM resides in a UHV chamber that is shown in the left-hand side of this plot. Our favorite infrared source for this is this femtosecond fiber laser. And the way it works is that these are actually two lasers with slightly different colors that we can mix one with each other, and that yields broad, extended mid-infrared spectrum. And using a Michelson interferometer, we can perform spectroscopy at continuous wavelength spectroscopy at every pixel in our images. We can take one of these colors out, and we can put it along the delay line, and this allows us to obtain pump probe information about samples we investigate, and we can have movies of time evolution of photo-induced signal, for example, in graphene with time scales going maybe down to 100 femtoseconds. So how do we understand this oscillating data at the edges of our samples? We think that these data present the real space image of surface plasmons on the surface of graphene. So why do we think so? Well, first of all, we know that our graphene samples are very heavily doped, and the carrier density in this graphene sheets is pretty high, and at this high carrier density, we would expect to find plasmons in our samples. Surface plasmons are not specific to graphene; they are omnipresent in metals and in semiconductors. There are some very special characteristics of plasmons in graphene, but general behavior, including this square root Q dispersion of plasmons, is quite generic. Plasmons are dormant in conventional optical experiments, and that's because plasmons are fundamentally finite Q modes, whereas Q of an optical experiment is really zero in this scale. But infrared nanoscopy allows us to move away from Q equals zero information, and it allows us to access values of range of Qs that roughly is given by 1/1 radius of this tip. Realistically, it's not just one single value. Realistically, it's a broadened range. Now, tune up, turn on your infrared laser, tune its frequency to match this dispersion. And if you do so, then you would be able to launch plasmons. The tip of your AFM probe would be able to launch plasmons with the wavelength given by this dispersion. So with the help of, and the typical wavelength of these plasmons in graphene turns out to be of the order between, say, 20 and 100 nanometers. And that's quite remarkable, because with the help of plasmons, we are able to confine light, long wavelength infrared radiation, this is about 10 microns, to length scales of the order of soft X-rays. And for all these reasons, plasmonics is really a very active area of research with brimming with ideas and with accomplishments. foundations of surface plasmons were discussed in pioneering papers by Pines and Bohm, and also by Ritchie and Farrell. And the notion of confining electromagnetic energy to small volumes, much smaller than the wavelength of light, has emerged really from these papers that go back to mid-50s. But the term plasmon, it turns out, has a much, much longer history and was used in the context of confining energy to small volumes back in 1903. This is from New York Times in January 3, 1903. And this is an ad for a wonderful product by a plasmon company of America. And this is not about confining light. This is about nutrition. And according to this ad, a teaspoon of sweet plasmonic powder provides the same nutrition equivalent of a beefsteak. And so this is clearly a very capable product, and it received a wonderful endorsement by Mark Twain. So surface plasmons have not received this kind of endorsements yet. And yet they steadily and slowly propagate into technology. And still, occasionally, when I read reviews on plasmonics, this is a new field for me, very new field. I started working on this just a couple of years ago. And when I read this application's review, I have this feeling that I've been sometimes sold a beefsteak, even though all what authors have is this sweet powder. Anyway, so it's a very exciting field. So now let's look at this remarkable property, I think, of propagating surface plasmons. So some of these plasmons go to the edge of the sample. When they reach the boundary of the sample, some of them become reflected back. And so and some of them even return back to the tip. So you form here with this help of your AFM tip and edge of the sample, you form a standing wave between AFM tip and sample boundary. And as you scan through this image, you go through these periodic oscillations that we observe in our images that occur at the length scales given by half of the plasmon wavelength. This is an average result obtained from a large number of scans. So unobscured silicon dioxide here on the left-hand side. Here we have this graphene extending up to the blue dashed line. And as you move your tip closer to the sample boundary, you observe several of these oscillations that become stronger and stronger close to the sample boundary. Now, it turns out that you can extract quantitative information on electronic losses in graphene by analyzing this pattern. And I'll go through this very quickly. The key idea is that there are really two sources of losses. That the two sources of rapid decay of the amplitude of these oscillations. First, you use a point source and point detector to register this plasmon, so most plasmons reflected from the sample boundary actually don't go back to the tip. You lose them. And so you would expect this decaying profile, as my colleagues Alex Rodin and Michael Fogler has calculated. But experimental decay of this amplitude is even faster than in this geometrical decay. So using the theory that Michael Fogler and Alex Rodin has come up with, we can extract the optical constants from these images of plasmons in real space. I'll skip all the details, just quote the results. The imaginary part of the conductivity is defined by the period of these oscillations, and the decay rate of of this pattern is determined by the ratio of the real part to the imaginary part. So looking at this image, just from the image, at one single frequency, you can obtain full information on optical constants of graphene layer. And that I think, is a remarkable achievement that Alex Rodin and Michael Fogler have been able to demonstrate here. So the physics of this is actually quite straightforward. An ideal plasmon the plasmon that doesn't have any decay can propagate infinitely far. In real samples, there are always losses, and that means that each of the data points on this dispersion curve is blurred. Okay? And now, with the help of this imaging, we can quantify its blurring either in momentum space or in frequency space, just like my photo emission friends are doing this with their set of tools. We are now able to do this with optical tools. In either case, the broadening of this plasmon dispersion is determined by the ratio of the two conductivities. So we can extract this conductivity from these images directly, and that's what is plotted in this panel. It's real part, this imaginary part. And the key finding that I would like to stress here is that this real part of the conductivity is huge. At frequencies at which we operate, that's about 10 microns, we expect the conductivity of doped graphene to be close to zero. Instead, we observe the value that doesn't even depend on gate voltage, and this stays at around half of this universal value. This result is in excellent agreement, in fact, with what we observed a long time ago with conventional spectroscopy. This result that we couldn't reconcile with ordinary conical band structure. The new aspect, as I told you, this conductivity is expected to be zero, but it's not, and now these near-field images confirm this finding. The new result that comes out of near-field imaging is that we can clearly see that graphene is of good quality in the regions where we perform these measurements. It's not phase-separated. It doesn't have holes in it. It's as perfectly as we can tell. So this finding of high loss of strong losses in near-field nanoscopy experiments that we obtain through plasmon interferometry supports the intrinsic interpretation of these results. I think I'll go to the summary now. In the summary, I would like to just highlight once again some of the key findings that we were reporting in this first results on imaging of plasmons in graphene. We were able to visualize surface plasmons using infrared nanoscopy. We were able to tune both the wavelength and amplitude of these plasmons by changing the gate voltage. This is something that you absolutely cannot do in metal-based plasmonics. So this is a very special and very important property of graphene that may enable indeed some applications. We were able to quantify losses in graphene layer by analyzing features of this plasmon interferometry pattern, and we obtained results that are supporting this intrinsic character of this highly anomalous absorption in graphene that we registered using conventional spectroscopy. Despite these strong losses, a number of plasmonic figures of merit are actually pretty good, even in this first generation of devices, and they at least match or in some cases surpass of state-of-the-art attainable with metal-based plasmonics. Most of these experiments have been carried out by Jeff A., a very talented graduate student working in our group, with participation also of Greg Andreev and Alex MacLeod, and Martin Wagner has set up our ultra-fast nano-optics These are my colleagues in chemistry. Samples of graphene come from the group of Jenny Lau at the University of California, Riverside. This work would not have been possible without my theory collaborators, Alex Rodin and Michael Fogler, are the really key people in this work, and also Antonio Castroneta. And the technique of near-field optics, I had the privilege of learning this technique from Fritz Keilmann, who is one of the originators of infrared nanoscopy. Thank you very much for your attention.